From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Georgia has a lot of black-owned businesses, but new research suggests they struggle to make it as much as white business owners.
If you ask any small business owner what their number one concern is, they will say access to credit. But when you ask black businesses, their top three concerns is access to credit.
We talk about this during this hour, plus a conversation with legendary singer Judy Collins. First, though, last week we talked about the cost of higher education.
Right now, in-state tuition with room and board is close to $15,000 a year.
That's Meredith Kladner, a reporter with the Hechinger Report. Here are your first thoughts. Laurel Van Rosenvinge writes to us on Facebook, "The cost of tuition needs to be addressed unless everyone's goal is to increase the income gap and make college and the best jobs only available for the wealthy. It's a bad cycle to be stuck in." Earlier this week, we also talked about how much we pay for health insurance, and Heidi King Purvis writes this on Facebook. "My salary is $30,000 a year, and for my family of three, I will pay at least $7,200 a year towards health care, and at most, $14,000. That is between a fourth to half of my salary gone on just health care. Where's the money for rent or mortgage, food, savings? When people debate the merits of a single-payer health care system, one of the first responses is, but taxes will increase, forgetting that premiums and deductibles will disappear." We love to get your stories and your opinions. Call and tell us what you think at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter and on Facebook, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. So far, it has been a very good year for the Savannah Bananas. Last week, Savannah's Collegiate League team broke the single-season attendance record. That's a record they set in 2016. And they are now playoff-bound once again. Joining us now is Jared Orton, president of the Savannah Bananas. Welcome, Jared.
Hey, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
So which are you more proud of, the attendance record or the playoff season?
It's quite the whirlwind of events. I think the playoffs are the icing on the cake, but certainly, you know, our staff of 14 people, I mean, we work our butts off from September to May, you know, meeting with this community and the business community and the nonprofits and the little leagues and the churches and the school, you know, everyone we possibly can, you know, to get them excited about coming out to opening day and the next game, the next game, the next game. And all of a sudden we look back at the end of the year and every game sold out and people are having a blast. And we've just been, you know, incredibly fortunate in Savannah, but it's been a whirlwind of events. And then here we are in the playoffs now. It's just icing on the cake.
So let me play a little clip from a mock commercial that you made for for your team. Let's take a listen.
A lot of people have been asking me, Jared, what do I do if we get a ticket this year? We want the food. We want the drinks. We want fireworks shows. We want the best games. Well, I've got a ticket package for you. I'm talking about you going to see the world famous Savannah Bananas. Stop having a boring summer. Stop having a boring life. Let's go to it.
So, how would you describe your sales pitch for the team?
Oh, my goodness. You know, we hired a videographer from Georgia Southern. He was an intern at Georgia Southern. We hired him on full time, and he just, you know, he wants to come up with these scripts and these, you know, different ideas, and he's nonstop coming up with just very, very funny bits. And we decided to bring back the infomercial. Obviously, it wasn't completely serious, but now people walk around the park and they call me the infomercial guy. So I suppose that went over quite well. But like I said, you know, we have Ben from Georgia Southern. He graduated there and is working with us now. And we love putting out the videos on Facebook and the website and all that. People, I hope, enjoy them.
All right. Well, let's hear another thing not related to baseball that brings people back to the games. This is one of your first base coaches. This is Darius Johnson speaking to WSAV.
So my first day was like, okay, here I go, dancing in front of these people who don't usually see dancing at a baseball game. People are loving that there is this different aspect of art at a baseball game. So it's like we're marrying one art with another, and that's what I really love.
I mean, how do you encourage people? How do you approach a first base coach and say, hey, could you also?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, we're trying to provide this incredible experience for a wide range of people. And not only do we have baseball fans coming to the game, you know, we have young kids, black, white, you know, rich, poor, male, female. We have such a wide variety of folks that are coming to our games. that we want to have this entertainment for everybody. I'll give you an example. Obviously SCAD is here locally, and they had a ton of their prospective students coming to games throughout the summer with their summer programs and all that. And obviously, you know, most of those are very, they're younger kids, they're 16, 17 years old. They're not quite interested in baseball. They're interested in the arts. And Darius goes out there in the second or third inning, and he starts dancing. And all of a sudden, you know, these kids that are potentially going to SCAD look up, and they are completely engaged in the game the rest of the night. And I thought, you know, that's what it's about. It's getting people to come to the game, and whether they're there for baseball or not, hopefully they have a great time. And if that's good food or good drinks or good entertainment, whatever that is, you know, hopefully we have something for everybody. And Darius does a great job. I mean, he's signing autographs after the game and taking pictures. He's actually teaching, now some dance lessons around town. And we think we might go even further, you know. Maybe this next fall we can travel around the state and start giving other coaches some dancing lessons. Who knows?
How do you keep the players from being distracted? How do you keep them focused on their game with all this other stuff going on?
You know, it's interesting. When they first get here, and these are, you know, the top college players from across the country, and when they first get here, we obviously explain to them, guys, you know, it is going to be a wild and fun summer. You know, you're going to play in front of some of the biggest crowds you could ever imagine. And to do that, we need you to go a little bit above and beyond what you might normally do at a baseball game. And, you know, you're going to dance. You're going to give out programs. You're going to give out, you know, roses to little girls in the crowd. But you are going to be loved by these fans in return. And they're going to ask you for autographs and pictures. And you're going to be, you know, the heroes of Savannah. And I think that kind of resonates with them, that, you know, they are doing something more than just playing baseball here. And our coach, Sean West, you know, he shares it with the guys when he's bringing them in and recruiting them and all that stuff as well. But, you know, I'll never forget last year, after they won the championship, you know, guys were coming up to us and, this was the best summer of my life. This was the best summer of my life. This is the best summer of my life. You know, I didn't believe you guys in the beginning saying that this was going to be so much fun, but it truly was. And that was just really special for us to hear that from those guys. And a lot of them came back, 3 or 4 or 5 of them came back for this season. And here we go, on to another playoff run.
So do you think that the players succeed despite all of the other stuff going on, or do you think somehow it adds to their play style and their abilities?
You know, I'd have to argue, you know, obviously unbiasedly, of course, but I'd have to argue that it adds to it. What's interesting is this: you know, we have won 21 games at home. We've only had 27 home games. At one point, we had won 18 of the last 20 games at home. Wow. Now, when they go on the road, the story is the complete opposite. When they're playing away from home, they've only won 7 or 8 games. So I really think it becomes home field advantage. I mean, our fans are into it. They're passionate. They're excited. They are being entertained in a different way. But to play in front of 4,000 people at Grayson Stadium in Savannah, I mean, it is a pretty special place.
We only have about a minute left, Jared, but is this advice that you would give to other, not just collegiate league teams, but minor league teams too?
Yeah, I think in general, you know, whatever people are doing, you got to start doing the exact opposite sometimes and just mixing it up. You know, and we've been in minor league baseball before with different teams, and our owners have as well. And a lot of times, you know, we just kind of get in the same old every single year. And, you know, people are expecting different things. Even last year, you know, after we had sold out a lot of games, we were somewhat successful and won a championship, you know, as you probably hear all the time, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? And, you know, I wanted to celebrate a little bit, but that's what people want. They want the next thing. And even this year, you know, even if it's so successful, 2018, it's got to be something new, something different.
Yeah, and, that's you know, we have to end there. But that's Jared Orton.
Fine.
He's president of the Savannah Bananas. Jared, thank you.
Thanks, Celeste. I enjoyed it.
G WGPB's Taylor Gant caught up with a few Banana fans last year, right after the team won the Coastal Plains League Championship. With the team in the running again this week, we look back at their favorite moments from 2016.
I'll tell you, I went to every ball game. I watched the Bananas play. I still love my Atlanta Braves, but hey, I'm a Banana fan for sure. My name is Greg Miller. I live here in Savannah. Been a fan of baseball my entire life, and I'm old enough to remember when Dale Murphy played for the Savannah Braves team. So I've watched a lot of baseball at Grayson Stadium over the years. And to see 4,000 people standing and cheering and to hear that stadium rocking.
And he dives! And he's got it! He's got it! And the Bananas are CPL champions!
I don't know that that's ever happened in that stadium at any point in time. And I remember looking around and going, you know, wow, what a moment in the history of Savannah baseball, the town that was defined as not being a baseball town, has suddenly become an awesome baseball town. And it's these crazy yellow uniforms with the banana running around. That's what brought it here. That was when it just kind of hit that this is a pretty big deal.
As Shark, the PA announcer at Grayson, says, the bases are full of bananas.
My name is Sally Yarber, and I live on Tybee Island. My husband and I had season tickets to the Savannah Bananas this year, and we absolutely love this season. When we had the other team here, they played twice as many games, and so they were gone a lot. There was no accessibility. We couldn't have any interaction with the boys. Now, where my husband and I sit is right behind the catcher, and so we can see them, we know them, we have clappers, so we're noisy and they know who we are. But when we would see them out in the community, they were always friendly. They would talk to you, you'd ask them where they were from. It was just a totally different kind of group of boys.
Let's go, Banana! Let's go, Banana!
They always had a thing called a home run hitter, and they would get a child generally who was really too young to play ball, and he would hit the ball off the tee, and then the players deliberately would overthrow or miss a ball or take too long, and this little child got to run from home plate to first, second, third, and back to home. But one night they had a young man in a wheelchair, and he was being pushed by one of the players. And this fella got to hit the ball and make a home run. And then at the end, you get to keep the ball. And he walks through doing high fives with all of the players. It was just so moving for me as a mother and a grandmother. But anybody watching that had to have been moved. It was just wonderful.
Savannah Bananas fans, Sally Yarber and Greg Miller. The Bananas postseason continues Friday. Just ahead, we sit down with legendary singer-songwriter Judy Collins. But first, a look at why businesses owned by African Americans make far less money on average than those owned by white people. This is On Second Thought.
So don't stop me now.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Turns out Georgia is a good place to be if you're an African-American business owner. That's according to an article by the personal finance site NerdWallet. And it's not just Atlanta. Savannah and Columbus scored high marks as well. Cindy Yang is the author of that article. She's formerly head of the small business division at NerdWallet. And we talked to her about this back in 2015.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's the purpose in NerdWallet having this particular survey? Why do you run a study on where it's good to be a black business owner?
Well, you know, we wanted to look at what factors really drove small business growth because they play such an important part in America's economic growth. And so we were looking at all the different types of statistics around small business growth. And one thing that caught my eye was that in 2010, Babson College released a study saying that 12% of white workers were self-employed, but only about 4% of black workers were self-employed. And so that spurred the interest in trying to figure out why is it that disparity exists and what can we do about it?
So what can one do about it? I mean, a lot of times the things that small business owners complain about, especially minorities, is reflected back in terms of institutionalized racism. So how does a state make oneself welcoming to small businesses owned by either women or people of color?
Yeah, and more generally, speaking across for all minorities, I think one thing we learned in just speaking to a lot of minority business owners, black business owners, women business owners, is that the sense of community is so important. It's really important that you have a community of successful mentors to turn to. Sometimes you have really tough questions that you really need someone you can lean on, someone you trust, someone who can understand your struggles. And so for us, that's why we turned to the study on best places to start your business, because the location in which you start your business is so important, both for the economic factors, but also for the softer qualitative factors of just having mentors and role models to turn to.
So what were the measures that you used to judge which cities were good places for minority-owned businesses?
Yeah, we used two things, two broad metrics. One, we weighted economic development, and that's just measures for the local economy. How is it doing, you know, unemployment? The second factor was more specific to black-owned businesses. We wanted to see how many black-owned businesses were there in a certain area. Are there role models that you can turn to? What's the average revenue of a black-owned business, and what's the percentage of black-owned businesses with paid employees? So we looked at both the local economic environment as well as the success of local black-owned business owners.
And I wonder what surprised you in there. I mean, I guess I was kind of surprised that in a state like Georgia, where we have such high unemployment and we've been slow to emerge from the recession, that we would have three cities, Columbus, Savannah, and Atlanta, that showed up on your list.
Yeah, you know, Georgia showed up on our list. In fact, Georgia held 3 out of the top 10 spots. And so it stands out because the high rates of black ownership. You know, you look at Columbus, 34% of businesses are black owned, Atlanta, 23%, Savannah, 20%. That's really high when you compare across the median of 111 metros that we compared. The median there is only 5%. So we're looking at numbers of 6 times that.
And I wanted to go to the key takeaways that you labeled in your article. And one of the things that I kind of understood was, to a certain extent, a city needed to have history on its side, that it needed to have a generations of minorities going back in order to create that sort of nurturing environment that you were talking about. Is that correct?
Certainly. I mean, that's how we measured it. We think that the past is the best predictor of the future. So we looked at whether current black-owned businesses were successful in a community. What better way to measure your propensity or probability for success than looking at the past?
And so tell me a little bit about some of the other areas and what kind of commonalities, besides just generations of minorities living there, any other commonalities that you found?
Yeah, I mean, we saw, one, broadly speaking, Georgia, but also just generally the South was an amazing place for aspiring black entrepreneurs, and that's largely because of the percentage of black-owned businesses. So this is to your point about having a successful community and having, like, successful, past and institutions to carry down, bring down the knowledge. But also, secondly, we found what was really interesting was that a lot of these businesses are local mom-and-pop businesses. These aren't franchises or large conglomerates. When you look at the percentage of black-owned businesses with paid employees, that figure is pretty low. I mean, single digits for most of the 111, if not all of the 111 metros. So these are truly small businesses, one- to two-man shops that are supporting our economic growth.
That's Cindy Yang, formerly the head of the Small Business Division at NerdWallet.com. While Georgia may be comparatively better for African-American business owners, that doesn't mean it's easy. A recent Prosperity Now study finds black businesses face pretty big hurdles in the South. White-owned businesses average over $500,000 in revenue every year. Black businesses average just a tenth of that. Joining me now is Dennis Kimbrough, professor of business at Clark Atlanta University. Hello there.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what you think of this particular study and whether or not you find it credible that black-owned businesses would be making just a tenth of the profit of a comparable white-owned business.
Well, number one, I would like to applaud the authors for bringing this to light. But you know what? They're really not saying anything new. I was just listening to the survey, the comments before, and when you look at the South, it's really bifurcated. There are some areas of the South that are really struggling for entrepreneurs, and there's some that are really flourishing. Atlanta happens to be one that's flourishing, and it's flourishing for a reason. There are, you know, common attributes when you look at success and successful black businesses. Number one, do they have access to capital? Number two, do they have the contacts? And number three, what about the contracts? The best customer in the world is a repeat customer, and that will certainly put any entrepreneur, whether black, white, green, whatever, on the fast track.
Let's go with that first one, access to capital, because let's play this comment from Ron Busby. He's the president of Black Chambers. He's speaking here with Roland Martin on News One Now, and he's pointing to exactly that as possibly a reason why black-owned businesses struggle more.
If you ask any small business owner what their number one concern is, they will say access to credit. But when you ask black businesses, their top three concerns is access to credit. And it has very little to do with our acumen. It has very little to do with our businesses. It really is a conversation about banks not wanting to take the risk to be able to provide those loans to business owners in our communities.
How much of a barrier is access to credit or liability, trying to convince a bank for black-owned businesses?
Well, I tell my students at Clark Atlanta University, the first step to entrepreneurship is savings. The reason why, if you can't save 10% of everything that you earn, the seeds of greatness aren't in you, because that's when opportunity really occurs. And if you don't have the savings, I mean, you are thrown on the cusp of either looking at the SBA for a loan or going to
the
commercial
Small Business Association.
Going to commercial credit. Financial literacy is the key, and I can sit here and tell you all the indices and indicators or the lack thereof of financial literacy in the black community. 27% of African Americans have no savings plan, more than 30% spend more on a weekly basis than what they bring in, and more than 40% of African Americans are non-banked or unbanked. Well, that's going to spill over into you pursuing an opportunity. If you don't have the funds to go ahead and capitalize that, regardless if it's a high hurdles, low hurdle, or whatever, you won't be able to participate in that market. So, you know, things happen for a reason. I shared in another conversation that I had in 1934, Federal Housing Authority came up with that idea of redlining, where they took a red pen and they drew it around certain areas within metro areas. Well, redlining has legs, and it occurred in 1934, and here we are in 2017. You are seeing the end result of years of discrimination in terms of economic development.
I just want to make sure our listeners are all staying with us. Redlining is a process in which someone is refused either a bank loan or insurance, mm-hmm. even, because they live in a particular area that's either deemed to be majority minority or it's deemed to be poor. Mm-hmm. And so therefore they're charged there. Even if you do get a loan, if you're redlined, you charge more.
Charge more in interest. Without a doubt. In terms of suppressing
economic development. And
your insurance
premiums will be higher.
Exactly. So, you know, that certainly has an effect, but that doesn't mean that, you know, opportunity is insurmountable. What's going on here in Atlanta in terms of contacts, I several years ago completed a 7-year study on black millionaires. Atlanta is either number 3 or 4 in terms of black millionaires. So new entrepreneurs or potential entrepreneurs, they can see what's possible and they have the contacts where they can reach out and seek mentorship and seek advisors, which is another key component. A lot of times, money is not just the answer. You need somebody to advise you and somebody to mentor you. Okay, what's the next step in the process? What do I do now? And then last but not least, contracts. You know, my mind goes back to the early 1980s when Maynard Jackson was mayor of Atlanta and he rebuilt, you know, Atlanta Airport, and he said we were going to use minority representation. Well, the bottom line, he created 14 black millionaires in the process of rebuilding that airport.
So let's hear one more comment. This is Connie Evans. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dennis Kimbrough. He's a professor of business at Clark Atlanta University, and we're talking about a new study that shows black businesses actually bring in about a tenth of the revenue that a similar white business does. So this is Connie Evans that we're hearing here. She's with the Association for Enterprise Opportunity, and she points out another problem with minority-owned business.
It's not only the wealth gap, the starting wealth gap, the starting the capital gap, but we also recognize a third important gap, which is the trust gap. But we found that the interplay of those three gaps is really what's keeping businesses from being able to reach their potential.
What is the trust gap?
The trust gap is if you can't find, you know, mentors, or if you can't find advisors that look like you, talk like you, think like you, whatever, then you're forced to go to different areas. Imagine I'm reading this study now where you have low-income black entrepreneurs seeking out somebody, you know, that's in their particular industry that they're in. They don't know anything about this individual. And the individual, if I walked into your office right now and I said, you know, I'm going to be your competitor in this line, can you share with me the pitfalls and how you overcame them? The trust gap is going to be pretty low. So you're going to need what we call executive presence. And what is executive presence? You're going to need somebody to skill you. You're going to need the, you know, the soft skills. You're going to need the norms and mores of how to compete effectively in a capitalistic economy. Long before anybody can trust you.
Okay, so if we're talking about a capital gap, and that's one of the reasons I assume why it's generational, because a lot of, I mean, I can think of three friends right now who only were able to start their business because their parents gave them a loan.
Exactly.
Zero interest loan in that particular case. So there's the capital gap.
And usually that occurs 25 to 30% for white entrepreneurs.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So, and that's not happening very often.
Not
generational wealth.
Only 42% of African Americans even own their own home.
Okay, so
there's no
that.
Equity there. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the access to capital. Mm-hmm. In terms of either loans and insurance. Mm-hmm. And then what you're calling is the trust gap. So what's our most powerful lever that we can throw to fix some of this?
You know, I hate to be simplistic in it, but what I have found is that nothing can stop the passionate, committed mind. What is the definition of entrepreneurship? And we need to know this before we go in. Entrepreneurship is the pursuit of an opportunity without any regard to the resources at hand. So what you are saying is that I don't have the money, I don't have the capital, I don't have the contacts, but this opportunity I'm going to pursue. There is something to be said about the passionate, committed mind. And I tell my students a lot of times, the passionate, committed mind can't be defeated. If it could be defeated, there would be no Bob Johnson of BET. There would be no Oprah Winfrey. So that's number one. Number two, you can't GET to your ASK. And the more that I tell my students, if you don't study, if you don't grow, if you don't develop, if you don't go to the seminars, if you don't go to the conferences, if you don't ask the key questions, somebody out in the universe will. And the day that you meet that other individual, you're going to lose. That's a part of the process. And then last but not least, people tell to me, Dr. Kimbrough, entrepreneurship is like a roller coaster. It's highs and lows and ups and downs and, you know, days in which I don't eat. And when does a roller coaster ride end? And I said, when you get off it. Entrepreneurship is gut-wrenching. Entrepreneurship is pain-inducing. Entrepreneurship is a marathon, not a sprint. It's built on inconvenience. But the good news is it's better than failing. If this is your chosen line of work, sooner or later, if you got the sticktivity, you're going to meet the contacts, the money will be there, and you'll be able to make a difference.
The sticktivity? That's a technical
persistence.
Term? Persistence. We only have about a minute left, but how much of this is also on black consumers and whether they choose to support black businesses or not?
Oh, that has a lot to do with it. You know, there are about 177 countries that belong to the United Nations. in terms of wealth, Black America's number 16. You know, our buying power is estimated to be $1.3 trillion of the $17 trillion U.S. market. But when you look at where we spend our money, less than a nickel of every dollar is spent in the Black community. No other ethnic group does that. I mean, if you look at the Asian community, the average dollar stays in the Asian community for 24 days. If you look at the Jewish community, the average dollar stays in the Jewish community 19 days. The average dollar only stays in the Black community 6 hours. So no other group does that. Our most prolific scholar, Black America's most prolific scholar, W.B. Du Bois, wrote a book in 1897 called The Negro in Business. And he had two profound, you know, sentences in that book. Number one, okay, if the man or woman who won't control their finances won't control anything else. And number two, nothing positive will ever occur in a community that fails to circulate its dollars.
That's Dennis Kimbrough. He's a professor of business at Clark Atlanta University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Just ahead, songwriter Judy Collins opens up about her creative process. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow we talk to the creator of the cult classic TV show Mystery Science Theater 3000. MST3K stars a janitor and his robot friends stranded in space, forced by an evil scientist to watch some of the worst movies ever made. And we want to hear from you. What is your favorite bad movie? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Singer and songwriter Judy Collins returns to Atlanta tonight with a concert at Atlanta's Symphony Hall. She's joined by singer and musician Stephen Stills of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. So let's revisit a conversation we had with Judy Collins a couple of years ago. I started by playing a 1973 performance she did of Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. And then here she is more than 40 years later with a cover of James Taylor's Belfast to Boston from her album Strangers Again.
There are rifles buried in the countryside for the rising of the moon. May they lie there long forgotten till they rust.
I asked Judy Collins to reflect on both of those chapters in her very storied career.
That was nice to hear that.
It's absolutely stunning to me.
It's amazing, yeah. It is amazing to me, too.
I wanted to start our conversation by saying thank you, because you don't remember this, but back in 1999, the second interview I ever did in my entire career in public radio was with you. And you were so kind and so generous with what must have been an awful interview.
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't. Listen, I think we have the gifts and we do them very well. You have a gift.
So let's go back to that extraordinary lack of difference between your voice 4 decades ago and your voice now, because again, that's not normal. We're very used to hearing people who are, especially in popular music, lose their voices, deteriorate. It's something that we're used to hearing, and I don't hear, I mean, your pitch is still exactly on. It's still just as clear and crystalline as it was decades ago. How is that possible?
Well, the secret is to work hard at it without working hard at it. I had a great teacher for 32 years, till he died.
A voice teacher.
A voice teacher. I studied everything growing up. I was in the choruses and the choirs, and I was a pianist. So
yeah,
I
you're a
piano.
Classical piano prodigy.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, Mozart and Rachmaninoff, etc. One of the things I have from that experience is a lot of understanding of what it takes me to do what I do. So I'm disciplined, but I don't push it, and I don't, I mean, I've had, like everybody's had, I've had health issues that have interfered and made it necessary for me to really buckle down and figure out how to do things, including having a surgery in 1977 because of a capillary on my vocal cord. It's called a hemangioma, so that was very scary. But I had a great teacher all those years, and he really helped me. Max Margulies was his name.
So I wonder, to what extent do you think that's a product of your classical music training? I mean, I'm a classical musician, and I always wonder if, you know, it's assumed that when you're in classical music that you will continue taking lessons for the rest of your life. You never become a master.
Absolutely, and that was my training. I mean, that's part of what the thinking is. I intend to do this like Toscanini. I intend to be at the podium until I fall over. You know, that's exactly the philosophy, and it is not so much in terms of classical music, but in terms of a classical approach. And also as an artist, it's a classical, quotes unquote, approach, which means that if you decide to be a painter, you'll be painting the rest of your life. And I'm painting with my vocal cords, basically. I mean, I have to keep them. I was so relieved yesterday because I hadn't been at a piano for a few days, and that's terrible for a pianist. And I got to my gig here, and I did my scales and my exercises and my Chopin, a little Debussy, a little this, a little that. So, you know, that's my, and I sang, of course, and warmed up for my concert. But it is, in a way, it's very simple because I know what to do, so I have to then keep the body fit to do it. That's maybe the hard part. The exercise, the meditation, disciplining yourself to get enough sleep. Don't drink, don't smoke, don't scream and go to the ball game and lose your voice. And hopefully stay away from colds and aggravating flus that can hit the voice. You know, I carry with me some things that help me get through that. But mostly it's a very, very disciplined life. And it's great. I love it. I'm very happy.
Let me play you a clip from 1976. This is your mentor, conductor Antonia Brico. And here she is giving a lecture to a group of college students about pretty much what we're talking about right now.
Sometimes the parents have said to you, can you make any living on this? If you want something, say this after me. Do not be deflected from your course. Now say it with meaning. Do not be deflected from your course. See, I'm also a choir director, and I'm just itching to get my hands on you and conduct you.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, that was 76, and I'll tell you a funny story. You know, I studied with her for all those years when I was growing up, so I heard that voice in my psyche all the time. Do not be deflected from your path. I would say it to everybody at all times, no matter what you're doing. You know, if you have an addiction to alcohol or drugs or food, do not be deflected from your path if you want to get well. Never stop looking for a solution. And I really learned that from my father and Antonia Brico. It's funny because that speech was 2 years after I made the movie about her, and it was nominated for an Academy Award. But she never forgave me for leaving the piano. I don't think she ever forgave me for not playing Rachmaninoff and Mozart. So, you know, she was never deflected from her path of trying to get me to stick with the piano and the classical music.
Did you ever think maybe I should have, I wonder what would have happened?
No.
Never looked back.
No. You know, she was a marvel. Her story is just extraordinary. She wanted to be a conductor. She was a woman. She was a student at Berkeley. Out here in California, all these big conductors would come through, and she'd take her music and her camp school and stool and sit at the foot of the stage and watch, she'd get herself hired up as an usher, and then she'd watch her score, and then she'd go backstage afterwards, and all these great conductors would tell her, you can't be a conductor, you're a woman, you know, forget it. And she was determined, and she made it to Germany, and her first big job was conducting as a guest the Berlin Philharmonic, which in 1929 was the orchestra in the world. That's where she started. So, you know, she was never deflected from her path.
Let me ask you a little bit about your collaborators, because, as you've mentioned, they're an incredible cast of characters on this new album. Michael McDonald, Don McLean, Willie Nelson, Jackson Brown. You also sing with the actor Jeff Bridges. And I wonder to what extent you, what process you go through to choose the right song for each different person. Or do you choose a song first and then try to find the right collaborator?
Actually, it's a sum of both, sum of many approaches. I had ideas, for instance, I knew I wanted to get this bunch of, I wanted to work with these particular men. I like them, I like their work, I like their music, I like their persona. I think they're very fine people and interesting singers and articulate people. With Jeff Bridges, I said, oh, wouldn't it be fun we could sing Crazy Heart together?
From his movie, yeah.
I said, Crazy Heart would really do me good. I'd love to sing that with you. He said, no, I'm not interested in that. But what I want to sing is the song from Candide called Make Our Garden Grow.
You've been a fool and so have I, but come, I'll be your wife.
Let us try before we die to make some sense of life.
It's really sweet. It's an odd thing because you hear Jeff Bridges coming in, and it's so different from what we know of him from his often gruff persona in movies.
Yeah.
And it's so sweet and lyrical and pensive. It's very different.
It's very different.
The world was sugar cake, for so our master said.
But now I'll teach my hands to bake our loaf of daily bread.
The duet with Willie Nelson, you couldn't get two more different voices than your voice and Willie Nelson's, and yet the pairing of the two becomes this beautiful alchemy.
Come, lonely hunter, chieftain and king, I will fly like the falcon when I go.
It's amazing. And that song, that was another thing that happened, that somewhere, when you begin to dig into a creative project like this, for anyone, and by the way, any kind of artist, whether you're a painter or a singer or a sculptor, when you dig into your own process, you find surprises and things sort of land in your lap. I was fooling around with a song called When I Go. I think that's one of the great singer-songwriter songs of the past 5 decades. I mean, it is so different and so imbued with the kind of the desert ideology and imagery that it comes from another place. It's very maybe Native American oriented, maybe something very Americana, but very unusual. And Willie said to me afterwards, he said, well, didn't we sing that good together?
And when the sun comes trumpets from his red house in the east, he will find a standing stone where all my chanted my release. He will send his morning messenger to strike the hammer below, and I will crumble down uncountable in showers of crimson rubies when I go.
You know, you have been judging panels for the Independent Music Awards for a long time. And I wonder how you feel about judging competitions, especially since voice competitions on TV have been so popular since the advent of American Idol and then The Voice and all these other America's Got Talents. I wonder how you feel about these competitions and how effective you think they are at actually identifying real talent.
You know, the talent show has always been a feature of American culture and other cultures. So the talent show itself, which is the model for all of these shows, is something I'm very familiar with. You're talking to the American Idol of 1956. I won a contest and these are still going on. The Kiwanians have a contests of that order.
Oh, you mean the Kiwanis Club?
Yes. For decades they've done this, and I won the Stars of America contest in Colorado, the four-state contest, and I won somebody put me in it. I didn't know who it was. Somebody's father put me in this contest, and I went and I won. And one of the fathers in the contest always says that his daughter, a classical violinist, was beat out by a hillbilly. They gave me $500, and they sent me to Atlantic City, New Jersey, to sing at the big convention center where Miss America is held. And
Do you remember what you sang?
I sang an old folk song, and my preceding act was the Marina Marching Band, and the act that followed me was the Air Cadets Choir. It was a very odd fit. They were very nice about it all, but they'd never seen anything like it. It was 1957 when I had to go and do it. I'd won the contest the year before. So I know about contests. I could have fun, I suppose, on American Idol or You've Got Talent or something. It would be interesting because I have the feeling that what I do is unique, and I do think it's unique, and I don't think that much interest in it exists. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to sing and everybody to say to you, how great that you can still sing like you can. They're not very interested in the path of how I got to it, and they're also very motivated by the kind of singing they hear today, which is, in terms of young people, something very different. It's funny. You know, the country singers keep their voices, most of them. Not all of them, but many of them do. It's primarily because they're telling a story. They're not interested. You know, my teacher would say, you're not interested in how pretty your voice sounds. What you're interested in and deeply passionate about must be the lyric, must be the story. I listen to a lot of Pavarotti, a lot of Ella Fitzgerald. So taste in music changes. I don't think that a great singer with a great ability to put across a story is ever out of fashion. I think that's probably true.
Singer and songwriter Judy Collins. She performs at Atlanta's Symphony Hall tonight with singer and musician Stephen Stills. The show starts at 7:30. You know, we talked earlier about the challenges facing Black business owners, and we would love to hear from you, especially if you've ever tried to start your own business, either successfully or otherwise. What stood in your way? What were your biggest obstacles? We want to hear from you. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. You can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day. Let's close with Judy Collins. This is Chelsea Morning.
I woke up, it was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that I heard was a song outside my window, and the traffic wrote the words. It came ringing up like Christmas bells and wrapping up like pipes and drums. Oh, won't you stay? We'll put on the day and we'll wear it till the night comes. I woke up, it was a Chelsea morning.